Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know where we are in this debt limit shutdown thing, right? We are at the he said stage of things. From American Public Media, I say this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 8th of October. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. And we have degenerated here on this eighth day of Government Interrupt Us into the land of dueling press conferences. President Obama went first today. Speaker Boehner went second. Marketplace's David Gura drew the short straw. He goes third because he had to watch them both. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai. How you doing?
I'm all right. So listen, was there any news, actual news, out of these news conferences?
Not really, actually. Yeah. I mean, President Obama spent a lot of time talking about the shutdown and talking about the debt limit, and he repeated something that he said several times now, and that is that he'd be willing to negotiate with Republicans in the House after the government shutdown ends and after there's no longer a threat of a default. The president told reporters that he said the same thing to the speaker this morning when they talked by phone. And as you said, the speaker gave his own press conference this afternoon, and there was no indication that he'd be willing to raise the debt ceiling without concessions from the president or from Democrats. So you get the sense that what may come out of this is, and this is a very Washington term here, is some sort of grand bargain, something that would take care of both of these issues, the shutdown and the debt ceiling, and there'd probably be a few other things thrown in.
Yeah, the president went an hour and change. Speaker Boehner went 3 minutes and change, and that is not an exaggeration. Was there any mention of healthcare reform, the healthcare act that was at the start of this whole shutdown thing?
Speaker Boehner did not utter the word or the neologism, I guess, Obamacare. The president did bring it up himself. There were no questions about it. Again, the focus here seemed to be on the debt limit. And, you know, a reporter asked the president if he had any emergency powers at his disposal, that, you know, if we were to default, you know, were there any sort of tricks up his sleeve? And the president said that there aren't a bunch of other rabbits in our hat. Those were his words. And that when it comes to emergency powers, the administration's really done what it can.
So a lot of the strategies that people have talked about, well, the president can roll out a big coin and or, you know, he can resort to some other constitutional measure. What people ignore is that ultimately what matters is what are the people who are buying Treasury bills think?
And that coin is that so-called trillion-dollar coin. Yeah. It's resurfaced again, this argument that the president could mint a trillion-dollar platinum coin, and that would some cover our bills. President Obama's point there is that if you or I think that's pretty outlandish, pretty out there, investors are going to think the same thing.
Right. And just for the record, the trillion-dollar coin does not have to be big. It could be small. Dimes are small. All right. Anyway, so let me ask you this, David. Is it possible that there is just too much time left until this whole thing explodes? We have, what, like 7, 8, 9 days left for there to be more talking?
Yeah, I mean, if you turned on your TV right now, you'd see a countdown clock. I'm not kidding. On CNN, that's ticking down the second.
It's 200-something hours, right?
Oh, my gosh. On the date on which Jack Lew says we're gonna hit this debt ceiling. Now, I don't know if there's too much time left, but there is time left. And you can either be optimistic and think, okay, that's more time to negotiate and to figure this thing out, or you can be pessimistic and say, you know, here we are again coming up on another crisis that we've known about for a long time. And just based on the simple fact that 1 week ago we faced another fiscal crisis, Congress couldn't get its act together. Why would the odds be any better this time around?
Quickly, David, before I let you go, how real is that October 17th date? There's been some commentary that there's some room there on the Treasury's part.
Yeah, I talked to a few people on Wall Street today. They're going to take the Treasury word at its face value, but they said, you know, it is fungible. And that's a real important distinction here, that when you look at that last deadline, when you look at the government shutdown, there was a point at which the government would no longer be able to stay open. It's different here, depending on what revenues are coming in, what bills the government has to pay. And that does make it somehow different and makes that date a little bit fungible.
Yeah. And also, we have hit the debt limit. We hit the debt limit.
That's
back
exactly
in May.
Right. A few months ago.
Yeah. The Treasury's been moving money around since then. All right. David Gura in Washington.
Pulling those rabbits out of the hat.
See you, man.
Thanks, Kai.
Be good. Bye-bye. So there has been some disquiet in the markets as the shutdown and the debt limit have become more real. But remember, this is a debt crisis. So let's look at the debt markets. Bonds, interest rates, yields on Treasury bills haven't really moved much, which is good news for the government. It is still super cheap to borrow, but the whole thing's a bit of a mystery because if government bonds look like they're about to default, why would anybody want them? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that part of this story.
This is a story about a kind of bond.
James Bond.
Yes, I'm going there. Now, let's say that bond is stuck on a train.
What do you mean on a train?
I mean they're on top of a train.
And let's say that train is headed for a cliff. Why would anyone want to get on that train? Because that's what's happening here. The train is the U.S. government. James Bond is our treasury bonds. And investors are like Bond's girlfriend hurling themselves onto the train despite the danger. They are still buying bonds. But if the government might default on its debt, why would you buy government debt?
We certainly do not anticipate that the U.S. government is going to default.
That's Josh Timmons. He's a managing director at PIMCO, a global investment firm. He, like many investors, just doesn't think Washington would be crazy enough to drive that train over the cliff. Scott Clemens agrees. He's a strategist with Brown Brothers Harriman.
It reminds me of that old Winston Churchill quote, "You could always count on the Americans to do the right thing after they have exhausted every other possibility."
Short-term bonds that might be due in the next month or so are getting a little scary. Their interest rates have jumped 0.25%. But even if the U.S. did fail to make an interest payment on some of its debt, investors figure they'd still get paid, just a little bit late. And there's another thing going on here, says Timmons at PIMCO.
The debt ceiling issue is negative for the entire capital structure of the U.S. economy. And T-bills and treasuries are still the safer part of the capital structure.
In other words, government bonds may not look so hot in the face of a shutdown and default, but you know what looks worse? Everything else. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Everything else indeed. So that was bonds. Stocks we will get to, and it is going to be ugly. People will have the details when we do the numbers. There are new $100 bills out today. All kinds of whiz-bang security features on the new Benjamins as well. A disappearing and reappearing bell in the inkwell that's on the thing. A new blue 3D security ribbon as well. The Federal Reserve has ordered a boatload of them. $350 billion in new C-notes are ready to go. But exactly where they're going to go? That's a bit of a mystery, as is the reason the amount of cash floating around out there keeps going up, even as we're pulling out our plastic more often. Marketplace's Adrian Hill did a little poking around on this.
Life has a few great mysteries. Where do the missing single socks go? Why do our children always wake up early on the weekends? And where's all our cash? You might be surprised to know that there's $3,774 in cash in circulation for each of us here in the U.S. But I don't have $3,774 in cash. I mean, today, if I look in my wallet, I got 24, maybe 80-some cents in change. And it's not just me.
Probably around $55. And that's only because I just pulled cash out right now.
I just bought something, so I know I have $17 on me right now, and I have $400 stuffed in a drawer at home.
Oh, cash, where are you?
We call this the currency enigma.
Edgar Feige is an emeritus professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
It's hard to figure out exactly where this currency is and why so much of it is out there.
And why the amount of cash has been climbing steadily. FICA says we can account for about 15% of it. The rest? Well, part of it's here in the U.S. We're just lying about it.
The currency happens to be an anonymous means of payment, and so it's actually the preferred means of payment in what we could generally call the underground economy.
Everything from not claiming tips or the money we pay our housekeeper to the real bad guy stuff, like drugs and prostitution. The U.S. loses hundreds of billions in unpaid taxes every year. Most of the rest of the missing cash is outside the U.S. Money moves quietly.
If somebody comes here and takes their currency, they get paid here, let's say, in Chicago, and they take their currency, their savings, back to their home village in Mexico. We don't know that.
Richard Porter is a senior policy advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. He's also spent time tracking money. He says there's a lot of demand from people in other countries looking for a safer currency than their own.
people tend to say, well, I'd better save my money in something else that's safer. And that's often tended to be all over the world, the U.S. dollar.
Which brings us back to the new, more colorful, less counterfeitable $100 bill coming out today. 100s make up nearly 80% of the cash in circulation. There are more $100 bills out there than 20s, which is kind of hard to believe, considering how rare it is that I actually have a $100 bill in my wallet. David Woolman is the author of a book called The End of Money. He thinks instead of printing new hundreds, we ought to be getting rid of them.
What are they doing to support the economy? They're not doing what cash is intended to do, which is to grease commerce. They're really just being used to enable illicit transactions.
We've killed currency before.
In the late 60s, Treasury finally decided to stop issuing $500 and $1,000 notes, precisely for this reason, to impede crime.
But ending the C-note may be a tough sell. Demand is strong, even if we don't know exactly where it's coming from. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Here with a dispatch from the Marketplace desk of Tell Me Something I Didn't Already Know, Will Ya? The government has confirmed that the collapse of healthcare.gov, that's the gateway to the new federal insurance exchanges, was the result of, yes, a massive technical failure. And yes, the people from IT are working on it around the clock. But in the meanwhile, your chances of ending the standoff in Washington are probably better than enrolling in an insurance plan online right now. That does not, however, mean insurance companies are sitting back and waiting. As Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, PA, it is time for the workaround.
The Affordable Care Act is now officially a punchline. Here's Jon Stewart last night on The Daily Show.
The galaxy-destroying dark force, known as Obamacare, was unleashed on an unsuspecting and yet still trusting world. How did it go? Just as I thought! Obamacare has exploded the chest cavities of millions of Americans.
Actually, it's more like millions of Americans have exploded the chest cavity of Obamacare. A week in and the federal exchanges are still barely working. But if you're set on moving ahead, Brian Lobley with Independence Blue Cross in Philadelphia wants you to hear this.
We launched IBX4U.com, which is our own shopping site.
Yep, that's right. Independence Blue Cross and almost all of the other Blues around the country have posted their exchange plans on their own functional websites. Many have conveniently included a calculator to help consumers figure out if they're eligible for the subsidies.
We're able to estimate what we believe your subsidy will be, so they're actually doing the shopping, doing the browsing, and then we're taking down their name and number and scheduling callbacks so we can roll them in the near future.
Of course, Georgetown's Sonia Schwartz says shopping on one site has its downsides.
I'm not going to be able to compare benefits, network. The idea is that that information will be clearer if they go to the state or federal marketplace.
So long as they start working fairly soon. University of Pennsylvania health economist Robert Town.
If these glitches continue to persist for another month or so, I think people get frustrated. People will not sign up. They'll say, I tried, you know, over and over, and it's just too much of a pain.
Which brings us back to Jon Stewart. While he skewered the online exchanges, he directed his sharpest criticism at us.
Let's get one thing straight about this country. We will camp out all night to be the first people to buy a phone or see a movie about shirtless werewolves. But you got 10 minutes to get me this health care. You understand what I'm talking about?
I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up, life at Silicon Valley startups isn't all ping pong and free food, you know.
It just doesn't stop, and your competitor is coming after you with a better solution, and you have to be responsive, and if that means that it's going to be, you know, another all-nighter, it's another all-nighter.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go. The wah-wah trombones have arrived. The Dow Industrial is off 159 points. 1% closed at 14,776. The NASDAQ tumbled 75 points, 2%, ended at 3694. The S&P 500 off 20 points, 1.25%, 1655 at the bell there. Shareholders hit the sell button pretty much across the board today, but it was an especially tough day for tech stocks as investors took their profits and ran. Netflix off 5%. Online travel site TripAdvisor sank 5.5%. Facebook lost 6.75%. One update on a tech stock that isn't. We told you Friday how investors piled into a penny stock thinking it was Twitter. Today, that company called Tweeter Home Entertainment said it would change its ticker symbol to avoid confusion. Shares off 72%, last traded at, yes, one penny apiece. Bonds off. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee is scheduled to take up the issue of housing finance reform. Stocking up on household stuff for the long winter? Costco hopes so. It releases quarterly earnings. And children in Washington and around the country participate in Walk to School Day by walking to school. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's really easy to fixate on the theatrics in Washington as the government shutdown extends into its second week. But out in the real economy, stuff matters. It matters to people and it matters to businesses. Yesterday, we talked about manufacturing, steel to be precise. Today, it's hogs, pigs, specifically how much those hogs are going for. It's more complicated than you might think because hog prices, yeah, they've been shut down too. Brian Duncan raises hogs in Polo, Illinois. Mr. Duncan, good to have you with us.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, Kai.
Help me understand how it works, how you guys figure out what price your hogs are going to go for.
Well, that's kind of a complicated question.
Give me the layman's version.
The layman's version would be in the old days. Let me tell you how it used to be in the old days. Producers called a local buyer and got a bid. The buyer would bid. We'd ask. And then agree to a price.
Right.
Over time, that's evolved, and you can say good, bad, or indifferent, that only about 6 or 7% of the hogs that are sold these days go on a bid and ask system.
Mm-hmm.
That price is used then to price the vast majority of the rest of the hogs marketed on a formula basis. It's called a formula marketing of hogs.
How big a deal is it for you not to have this government data then, this formula?
Well, it's a big deal. We're flying blind. I mean, packers are being forced to improvise, and so are producers. I was on the phone with a packer this morning, and they're going to start using private source data. It's going to be called the Urner-Barry Yellow Sheet is what we're going to use, and that's a private source firm that reports the price of cutouts. And then we're going to establish some sort of a formula off those cutouts to price the live hogs.
These cutouts, explain to me what those are.
Those are hams, loins, ribs, bellies.
So actually pieces cut out of the hog.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay. All
the
right,
the cutout, the value of each of those pieces is compiled, and every day we see cutout data, which equates back to the price of a hog.
So not only is it this private source data, but it's not even actual whole hog prices. It's being extrapolated from hams and jowls and cheeks and all that stuff.
Exactly. We're using the cutout. Exactly. We're using the cutout and measuring backwards.
Wow.
So we don't have slaughter data available to us. We don't know how many hogs are being killed a week.
Well, is it possible then, Mr. Duncan, and I'll put this in plain terms, is it possible you're getting hosed on the price of your hogs?
Don't know.
Huh.
Is it possible I'm getting paid too much?
Yeah, well, there's that too, right?
Don't know. You know, we're really flying blind here.
Brian Duncan, he does hogs out in Polo, Illinois. Mr. Duncan, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I appreciate it, Kai. Thanks for the opportunity.
Let's talk for just a minute now about expense accounts. You're out to dinner, on business, the boss picks up the check. Nice, right? Well, there's some new data out that sheds a little light on exactly where people with expense accounts do that eating. Here's Marketplace's David Weinberg.
When you think of someone dining out on an expense account, you probably think of a place like Drago's in downtown Los Angeles. Men and women in business suits seated at white tablecloths inside what looks like a giant greenhouse. The soothing sound of water flows from a fountain while the waiter talks about the chef's preparation of game birds.
For that being the pheasant, roasted, shredded, a little bit of the demi-glaze, and more on mushrooms sautéed into it.
It turns out that most people who eat on the boss's dime aren't having pheasant or pan-seared Mediterranean sea bass. No, they're eating Big Macs.
Can I get just the sandwich?
It's always interesting to me to see how much utilization there is of sort of convenience stores and fast food for business travelers.
Bob Nevue is the president of Certify, a company that processes over $4 billion in expense account transactions a year. Every quarter, Certify puts out a detailed report, and the most recent one showed that McDonald's was the second most popular place. The number one most expensed restaurant was Starbucks. Number three was Subway, followed by Panera Bread. And rounding out the top five was HMS Host.
A lot of people will know HMS Host as being, they'll run a lot of the restaurants and a lot of the major airports.
This may explain the results of the survey. People with business accounts are often on the go, as much as they would love to discuss quarterly sales projections over a vintage bottle of Côte de Nuit. There's just no time. Or they simply need Wi-Fi.
That makes a big, big difference. If you've got two restaurants and one you know has a Wi-Fi network that works and one that doesn't.
There's a good chance you will forego the creme brulee for a Starbucks cake pop if it means you can stream video, a work video, of course, not the latest episode of Game of Thrones. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Silicon Valley is in an unusual place. It's creative, it's high pressure, it's dysfunctional in some ways, economically vital in many others. Ken Goldstein spent 20 years working in and around Silicon Valley and the companies that have been born there. He has now written a book about the place. It's fiction. It's called This Is Rage, a novel of Silicon Valley and other madness. Ken, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
This is not a flattering portrayal of the technological center of the American economy, man.
Well, I think it's balanced. It has different points of view.
I won't give anything away by saying what I'm about to say. But this is a book about a radio shock jock, if you will, about a kidnapping gone bad, about bumbling and comedy and some very serious stuff. Is that the other madness that you refer to in the title?
I think what I want people to see is the other side, to get inside a boardroom, to get inside a venture partner meeting, to see what the discussion is, and to see how people react in crisis when they're under extreme pressure. What kinds of decisions do they make? Why do they make them? What are their personal agendas? What are their financial agendas? And then just the basics of personalities colliding.
You know, it's funny. So I was in Silicon Valley in the late 90s, the first time that we went through all this stuff. And the thing I think a lot of people don't understand, at least back then and to a certain degree still today, it's Silicon Valley is a bunch of strip malls along the 101 and El Camino Real and little companies tucked in there doing these amazing things.
Yeah. It's, in a lot of ways, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, it's a little like Hollywood. There's no place.
It's really
a frame of mind. I mean, Silicon Valley now can be New York, it can be L.A., it can be India. It's really more of a way of approaching business and innovation than it is necessarily a geographic location.
You know, that's an interesting thing that you mentioned. There is a tendency, and yes, it happens in other jobs as well. You know, here when the news is big, we all work without doing other things and on Wall Street, obviously. But it seems there is this thing in Silicon Valley that they wear as a badge of honor. We sleep under our desks. We're wearing rumpled clothes and eating three-day-old fast food and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I mean, it's internet time is extreme. It just doesn't stop. And your competitor is coming after you with a better solution. And you have to be responsive. And if that means that it's going to be, another all-nighter, it's another all-nighter.
It's a wonder people don't run fleeing from the greater San Francisco Bay Area.
It's invigorating. There's nothing quite.
He says, choosing a different word.
There's nothing quite like putting a new release in the market and seeing people adopt it and knowing that you can make changes to it and just being responsive to customers. It's very, very exciting.
Okay, but give me the other side of that then. What's it like to have that flop, the release that doesn't go well, the bug that crashes everybody's computer?
You know, there is no success without failure in anything that's creative and anything that's innovative, and we need to embrace those failures. If it's learning, it's not failure. It's the next step towards success, and the smart CEOs know that. The smart investors know that, and you let that learning sit in.
But the stakes of failure with, you know, some of these companies and...
Yeah, no, the fallout can be extreme. Mm-hmm. And then the question is really what happens to those workers, what happens to those people who gave everything to you? Do they get another chance?
Which is what this book is about. It's called This Is Rage, a novel of Silicon Valley and other madness. Ken Goldstein wrote it. He's here with me in the studio. Ken, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which A, most of us probably knew intuitively, and B, which I, for one, am totally guilty of. A company called Locket, which makes an app for Android-powered phones that tracks how often people unlock their phones in return for dealing with ads, says that on average, people check their phones 110 times a day. So in a 12-hour day, that's like once every 6.5 minutes, which, I know, just isn't healthy. Get a life, Kai, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow off 159 points. That is 1%. The NASDAQ tumbled 75 points, 2%. The S&P 500 down 20 points, 1.25%. Nancy Fargali, John Ketchum, and Jolie Myers are the producers on our Marketplace desks. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is 8 p.m.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.